Hello, this is the HSJ Health Check Podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and I'm joined by Ben Clover and James Illman. The NHS has just come out of arguably the toughest week of strike action, with 5 days of junior doctors' industrial action, followed by 2 days of consultants providing Christmas Day level of cover. So on this episode, we'll be discussing the damage done by these recent strikes and what's in store over the next few months. Perhaps let's start with some of the trends, some of the things that people have been saying about the most recent consultant strikes. Ben, I know you had some interesting conversations, particularly around London. What came out of the strikes? What sort of things did you learn?
Well, I suppose people all over, right? And this is obviously about, yeah, the consultant strikes on Thursday and Friday last week. And as always, NHS England puts out data on a number of rescheduled. These aren't cancelled, they're just rescheduled, although it'll feel the same as a cancellation if it was your procedure, like per trust and nationally. And they also put the number of people going out on strike, consultants in this case. So we sort of looked at the numbers, like nationally, by region, by trust, and on the first day, second day, it was about 14.7% of the total consultant workforce in England went out on the first day, 13.4% on the second day, which is a lot, you know, but it's still in terms of industrial action, it's not huge numbers. However, that denominator, the 54,817 consultants in the English NHS, obviously, not all of them are going to be rotated to work every Thursday, on any given Thursday and Friday. So someone will be off, like sick or on holiday or rest days or whatever. So the people I spoke to, kind of clinical leaders, managers, chief execs, all that sort of tier and lower down, like consultants as well, they all said it felt a lot worse than that. Well, actually, one of them said, no, that felt about right. Kind of, they said their percentage felt about right, i.e. about 50% of our consultants were off. Lots of them said, more of them said, like, oh, no, we it felt about twice as bad as that. So obviously, it's worth contextualizing here. Kind of, this is the first proper consultant strike in decades. You know, there's not been, there was one in 2012 that was sort of part of an all medics kind of one day strike that was kind of symbolic, but this is the first proper one. And like you say, yes, they committed to providing Christmas Day levels of service. So what does that mean? In practice, it means we'll staff the emergency care pathways. But as we'll come on to a little bit later with James, kind of like there are going to be huge numbers of elective cancellations. Tons and tons of them. But within the data, there's quite a lot of, and imperfect as that is, like we, you know, I'm at pains to caveat this data, like about a sixth of trusts didn't provide any data on how many of their consultants went out. A lot of data is still coming in to be assessed, like, oh, what do we want? Better data. When do we want it? Now. Kind of, it's still coming in. So those caveats aside, right? It seemed like, and I've not spoken to anyone who's given me a convincing theory for this yet, but it seems like the consultants at mental health trusts were disproportionately likely to participate in a strike compared to their colleagues in general acute hospitals or specialists. Really, yeah, kind of quite strikingly high. Not only the higher percentages, but of, you know, of the 30 trusts with more than 25% going out, kind of half of them were mental health trusts. And which I found a bit puzzling, because I went to the most recent staff survey data we had and looked up kind of consultants and their general satisfaction with pay. And it was consultants working in mental health services were considerably more satisfied with their pay than their counterparts in the general acutes. Again, kind of like, you know, order of magnitude different, which made me suspect that kind of like, obviously, like the arguments you see about this are about percentage uplift in wage and the erosion of wages For these professionals over the past 20 years or so. But quite often there's more than that to the psychology of whether you decide to go out on strike or not. And I wonder if, despite being happier with their money, if consultants in mental health services generally feel a bit more pressured. I think mental health services kind of seem to be under considerably more pressure. Not that there's no pressure anywhere else in the system, obviously. Don't email. And then just anecdotally, although this is anecdotal from about 12 different people, it seemed that, senior management people, medical as well as non-medical, anaesthetists disproportionately represented. So lots of managers said to me, they didn't have very good intelligence on who was going to go out until the day. So hard to plan for. So you would plan on not booking a lot of work for these days anyway, because you can't be sure who's going to show up. But without the anaesthetists, there's a lot of inpatient stuff you just can't do, surgical stuff, inpatient stuff. You just can't do without them. Again, I'm not entirely sure. No one can give me a particularly convincing reason why anaesthetists might be better represented amongst the people that participated in the strike. And the final thing, the other thing that seemed to be people made a point of, was it was broadly the younger consultants who were more militant. And I guess maybe they've got more of their career ahead of them, so it's a more important issue to them, perhaps. But it's important to stress that this isn't, even if the totals, the proportions are double, effectively double what was reported here, even if it's 30%. That's a fair old schism in a profession, I also got told about, serious conflict within the profession between people going it's not right to strike. Some people think you are the named clinician responsible for this person's care. It's not right to strike. Is an argument. This is not arguments I'm advancing. This is what some parts of the profession say. Whereas other people feel just as strongly no, this is a completely legitimate course of action to take. I expect a bit more difference regionally, but there wasn't all that much. The most vociferous, I mustn't say militant, the most vociferous in defence of their pay, broken up by region, appeared to be consultants in the east of England and the northwest, about 20% compared to the average of 14.7. The least seemed to be in the southwest. I can think of no earthly reason why that would be, but that's about where we got to in terms of talking to people. I think it might take a large scale scholarly exercise to really bottom out exactly what happened here.
Right, thanks, Ben. And of course, this would have had a huge impact on the work done in the NHS. Firstly, over the 5 days of the junior doctor strike, and then over the 2 days of the consultant strike. And James, you were looking at some of the data, which of course has the caveats that Ben was talking about, and that it's not complete. But what did you get from the data that is available?
Yeah, lots of caveats. I mean, there's before I go into that data, I just want to add some more caveats in there. So first of all, the data is for work that is cancelled or postponed very late on. So what we've been seeing is now that trusts know that a strike is coming up, they just simply don't book slots. So to get the kind of total amount of activity that's not being done by the NHS during the strike periods, you'd need to tot up both the slots that are just going empty, which would usually be full, as well as the postponed work. But we don't have the data for the unbooked slots. So all we're getting is postponements. And so these numbers underplay the seriousness and the quantum of work being postponed. But that's not to say that the data is completely useless. it gives us a kind of, you know, a finger in the air, a kind of starting point. So over the 2 days of the consultant strike, there were 68,000 appointments, there or thereabouts, just under, postponed. So, you know, about sort of 35,000 a day. And this took the total amount of cancelled elective activity over all the strikes, which have taken place so far, to over 800,000. So we're talking, you know, really big numbers. So 35,000 a day postponed during the consultant strike. How did that compare with the junior doctors? Well, during the 5-day junior doctor strike, so that's the strike, that the most recent strike and the longest strike, there were just over 100,000 cancellations in the acute. There's about 11,000 inpatients and about 91,000 outpatients. So about 20,000 a day. So that's 20,000 a day compared to 38,000 a day for the consultants. But if you look back at the previous strikes, so there's, to date, there have been now 4 junior doctor strikes, one in March, one in April, one in June, one in July. In that March strike, there were just over 58,000 a day postponements. So 58,000 compared to 20,000 in the most recent strike. Then that went down to 49,000 in the April strike, then down to 35,000. And then 20,000. So what does this tell us? Does this tell us that lots more work is not being cancelled? Well, maybe a little bit, a tiny bit, because, you know, we do know that trusts are getting more of a handle on how to run things. But the main thing is not that at all. The main thing is that more slots are being left unbooked. So in terms of the total damage done overall to activity not being done, it's, you know, who knows? We don't really know. But the suspicion of a lot of people I talk to is that, you know, the amount of postponed work has not dropped from, you know, 60,000 down to 20,000 a day. It's that's a reflection of this issue with slots not being booked now. So so that's sort of how things are looking in terms of the overall numbers. Likewise, in terms of the turnout, in terms of staff absent in the junior doctor strike, that number appears to be coming down. So 28,000 a day, nearly 29,000 a day in the first strike, and that was down to about 15,000 a day in the July strike. But again, the time of year, it's very hard to kind of draw direct comparisons. The July strike was the first one that was over a weekend, so obviously that plays havoc with the numbers. So while, yeah, there's something we can glean from the numbers, I think we need to be very careful about how much we kind of take from the numbers, and we don't treat them as a sort of you know, something we can refer to, but they're no more than that. They're no more than a kind of finger in the air. And the only sort of firm conclusion I could kind of draw from all of this was that this kind of plan, strike, recover cycle, one of the integrated care board leaders put it to me, you just can't kind of go on. It's just not remotely sustainable. As we know, we've spoken a lot in the past about, you know, the burnout and the exhaustion and the anger caused by all of this, both sort of within departments, within hospitals, patients getting very upset with work being their procedures and operations being cancelled, but equally that was happening before. So, you know, if you were to give the kind of why should doctors continue to strike, well, this is what they've been striking about, right? There's the whole issue of the service getting more and more unsustainable in the eyes of a lot of people, and postponements and all these things. So, but it's certainly, yeah, I mean, the idea, as we mentioned at the top, it's going to be another 4-day 4-day strike in August. Yeah. By the junior doctors, you know, 4 days, that is going to be another tricky period. But the idea of these kind of walkouts happening in winter, you know, the one in March, it was pretty wintry in March. But the idea of, you know, going through a full winter full of strikes again, I mean, that really doesn't bear thinking about. That would be an absolute disaster for the NHS. So, yeah, fingers crossed people get around the table. But yeah,
I mean, I don't know how hopeful I feel about that. I mean, this August strike is going to be interesting because it comes, I think, just over a week after doctors rotate around. A lot of F1s will be starting their first ever jobs post medical school, so it's a really big time for the NHS, a time of big change. So I can't think, I think someone commented below the line and the story we wrote about it this morning, saying sort of even in the best of times, August is tricky, and it's very much not the best of times at the moment.
No, far from it. No, it's going to be, I mean, yeah, this August strike. And by the time that's been done, there will have been 19 days of strike days by junior doctors alone this year, which, you know, there is so many days worth of activity that the service just can't get back. And when you look at, I mean, they've already lowered the elective activity targets for this year, as we discussed a few weeks back. That is presumably going to have to happen again. NHS sort of system level leaders, the line is still, yes, we're going to hit our next long waiters target, which is to eliminate or virtually eliminate all the people who have been waiting over 65 weeks by March. I think the word virtually in the we're going to virtually eliminate sentence, the word virtually is going to be doing a lot of heavy lifting, because I don't really see how that happens with the, you know, obviously people will caveat, well, if industrial action continues, then it won't happen. But I mean, already, I think that's going to be really, really tricky. And then, of course, there's, you know, the prime ministers, we're going to have the waiting list reducing target, which he made in January in his New Year's speech, part of the kind of five big priorities for government. I guess you could say, well, it's going to depend at what point they're going to say it's reducing from. The waiting list has started kind of creeping back up again, having started to kind of stabilize it just over 7 million. It's now sort of creeping up. So, it's all looking very, very, very tricky.
I always thought when they said virtually eliminate long waiters, they meant you will receive a Zoom call alongside five other people, and then you will all be ticked off as having been seen. Kind of like, I'm not just being flippant on this, because like, I've spoken to some waiting list people this week on electives who said, you know, what are we going to do about the mass of outpatients? Kind of just the huge proportion of a total. And, you know, kind of like, it's not unprecedented, i.e. like IAP services and mental health have been doing group CBT for a while, you know, to kind of hit. And I was like, you know, people are often quite surprised to rock up to these services and then find like, oh, I sort of, you know, like our image as patients is kind of like, oh, I'll sit on a couch and someone will ask me about problems, in the same way, like your image of a lot of acute services is I will go and I'll be seen by a physician. Whereas in fact, you know, people may well be looking at quite a different sort of consulting model quite soon, I would have thought, purely from the exigencies. We mustn't forget, just because it's this week as well, and it's one third of acute trusts, the radiographers strike is on.
Yes.
Lots of people, it's easy to get confused between radiologists and radiographers, because they sound similar, the words. Just to be clear, these aren't the consultants that interpret the scans. These are the radiographers actually take the scans, and you can't interpret a scan that's not there. That's this week. One third of trust was actually a kind of higher turnout than I expected, actually, for this professional group. And it's worth pointing out that in the pretty alarming cancer performance for the English NHS, kind of diagnostics is one of the most challenged. God, if you write about the NHS for too long, you start using words like challenge. It's one of the bits that's most disastrous in comparison to the waiting times targets you're supposed to have. Like, no more than 1% of people wait more than 6 weeks, and we have never larger backlogs, never larger numbers of people waiting more than 13 weeks, and further still. So when I say I look forward to seeing the data that gets put out about the radio free strikes, I mean, I'd be interested in the effect it has, because this really is a sort of volume business part of the NHS, you know. And I don't know how mitigable. It was already hard to get people to work in it. The Society of Radiographers say, there's reasons for that. Like terrible pressures, people go and leave for better conditions in the private sector. You know, is this something that is even worth training in, considering like, oh, maybe AI will take over quite a lot of it quite soon? All sorts of doubts faces this poor group in the workforce, but they're the absolute kind of workhorse. You shouldn't say workhorse and workforce in the same sense, but they absolutely are a vital bit of a system. So the effect on the data might be quite tangible, even though we're talking about huge numbers in the diagnostics pathways anyway. So yeah, that would be interesting to know. I was just one thing to go back to consultants for a second. I was speaking to someone fairly senior in medical leadership, and I said, well, what do you think will happen? And he went, I think it maybe will go on into the winter, because the BMA and the government have got lost in they're entrenched, was the word, in their respective positions. And
the HCSA, I must add as well.
Of course we must. And it's hard to see what might suddenly shift it. Like people said to me, part of the problem for the junior doctors on their strikes is that their work can be covered and is covered at great expense to the NHS. Yeah. But that means that the effect isn't all that tangible sometimes to the public. I mean, it is if you see pickets, but you know, of course there are cancellations, but you can get people to cover it. You can't really get people to cover the consultant strike. That said, another chief exec said to me, the consultant strike felt like a junior doctor strike in terms of the amount of work we had to cancel. But the difference was we didn't even try to cover it. So it didn't cost me, you know, millions of pounds in overtime rates. You know, so yeah, God knows how it'll play.
Which is a consideration, isn't it? I mean, you know, I think as a patient, you just want to be seen. But if trusts start running out of money and start running into financial trouble, then it becomes really, really tricky. So even though all those numbers, and it all sounds quite sort of intangible, and it's costing, you know, millions and millions to pay for the backlog. Also, what the NHS costs billions and billions. So, but at that local level, it's there are going to, yeah, the amount of money that can be thrown at the problem will be more and more challenging, especially moving towards March and year end, and all these trusts, they all have their financial targets. So that could be an interesting part of the conversation in the coming months.
Yeah, it sort of brings me back to my thing about like, oh, why do the mental health consultants appear to be more unhappy? And that maybe sometimes pay disputes are a sort of, to some extent, a proxy for the general how happy you are at work. And it's easy to forget as non-clinicians that like clinicians hate cancelling people's operations. They hate cancelling people's procedures. Yeah. It kills them to kind of deliver poor care or poorer care than they otherwise would. So Yeah, no, I just thought that was a point worth making in this. It is easy yeah. forgotten when people are going like, well, 35% is unreasonable, and similar points, you know.
And I think as well, I saw somewhere, I think it was in the Times actually, reported that the BMA are balloting GPs for strike action, or look, considering balloting GPs for strike action, but I imagine they probably will do, considering the current climate. And I just thought that would probably cut through even more so.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't quite know what that would look like, whether it be another sort of working to rule, or, I mean, maybe they would walk out, but I mean, gosh, like everything, it would just collapse.
Yeah.
But I wonder, both of you, there's been a bit of sort of speculation about the health secretary's future, and obviously we're in the summer recess now, so nothing is going to happen for, you know, until the end of the summer. But I wonder whether that kind of, if there was a reshuffle, whether that could make a difference, because it really does seem like there's absolutely no give from either side. They've just, it's total impasse. The government have said, this is our offer, we're not negotiating anymore. And that's that.
And that's come from the Prime Minister. So, I mean, he was the one who said, that's our final offer. So if you change the health secretary, I mean, it does give a sort of a new chapter to some degree. And, you know, sometimes secretaries of state are moved on and new ones are brought in to kind of have a fresh start. And it could be an interesting symbolic move. It would certainly be something, wouldn't it? It'd be serving something to shift the dial. But I wouldn't be like, oh, new health secretary, hurrah, this is all going to be wrapped up now, because, you know, it's been the Prime Minister who's been very strong on the this is our final offer rhetoric. So
I just want to call it, the politicians do change their minds on things, and maybe it is easier to have a new health secretary do that if Sunak changes his mind. I'm just thinking about what they'd say. They're like, all right, we will give them this, but we want some efficiencies. And then the NHS has to be like, also no. Kind of, you know, like,
but the problem is the NHS leadership has often said, oh yes, fine, we'll deliver the efficiencies that we know we won't deliver, and then you know, at the end of the year goes, oh yeah, by the way, we haven't delivered that thing we said that we were going to deliver, but we always knew we weren't. And yeah, that's been sort of part of the problem of the sort of fantasy policy making of like the last, well, yeah, 10 years at least.
All right, thanks both very much. I think time to wrap up the podcast for this week. Just a reminder, our podcast is available every week on our website and wherever you listen to your podcasts, and do get in touch if there's something you'd like to see us cover. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next time.